Oil and Gas Company versus Atlantic Richfield. Ready whenever you are.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Shannon Stevenson on behalf of the appellant Atlantic Richfield. With me today is Elizabeth Titus, and I'm going to try to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Atlantic Richfield appeals from the judgment of the trial court ordering it to convey a piece of real property for a mere fraction of that property's value. The court ordered Atlantic Richfield to convey this property pursuant to a 1983 option, despite the district court's conclusions that equity had secured the option through misrepresentations made in bad faith to Atlantic Richfield, that equity had failed to perform other contractual obligations to Atlantic Richfield, and that the option violated the rule against perpetuities. Atlantic Richfield contends that each of these findings constitutes an independent basis for reversal of the trial court's judgment. There are three key points that I hope to cover today. First, with respect to Atlantic Richfield's unclean hands defense, equity argues that its unclean hands have somehow been washed by Atlantic Richfield's failure to later cancel the option. I will argue that Atlantic Richfield's failure to cancel is neither relevant to nor cures equity's unclean hands. Second, the district court held that although equity had breached the agreements between the parties, those breaches were not material because the trial court found that the agreements had two separate purposes. I will argue that the agreements had one purpose, oil shale research, and that to the extent property conveyances were part of the agreements, they were fully integrated into and part of the oil shale research purpose. Third, the district court reformed the option at issue in this case pursuant to the statutory rule against perpetuities. I will argue that the plain language of that reformation provision does not apply to the commercial instrument at issue in this case. I want to talk first about Atlantic Richfield's defenses of unclean hands and substantial performance.
Counsel, before you do that, what was the trial court's ruling on the unclean hands defense? Did it say that it had been waived below? Did it address it and say that there wasn't enough evidence established? What is the record on that?
Both, Your Honor, in the judgment, and I don't have the specific paragraph number now, but the court says other affirmative defenses, which included Atlantic Richfield's unclean hands defense, were not pursued or were not proven at trial. And let me address that issue. The unclean hands defense was absolutely in the trial, was part of the trial and was an affirmative defense that Atlantic Richfield pursued. It was included in the trial management order. The specific facts supporting the defense were outlined in the trial management order at page 10. The court during the trial said, I find that the unclean hands defense is in the case. Both parties repeatedly referenced the defense, including the counsel for equity. I would note that several times when he mentions the unclean hands defense at closing, equity's counsel says, well, I don't understand what the defense is, but if the court will look at the trial management order, the facts underlying the defense are entirely laid out, just as they are in our brief, which is in 1982, equity was facing the imminent loss of 60% of its remaining interest in the Boys Block. At that time, it approached Atlantic Richfield and said, we want additional time to pursue our oil shale research, but we need to maintain significant property interest to do so. Will you consider extending this conveyance that we're going to have to make to you and consider giving us an option so that we might purchase your interest in the property in the future? Based on the representation that the oil shale research was ongoing at that time and that equity was budgeted to continue on that oil shale research, Atlantic Richfield agreed to that amendment. Subsequently, it came to discover that equity had, at that very time it was making those representations, was shutting the entire research project down, mothballing it, and was reporting this to the Department of Energy without reporting it to Atlantic Richfield.
Okay, so assuming we agree with you for purposes of this discussion that you preserved the unclean hands, what are we to do with the trial court's findings that there was not enough evidence to support it at trial?
I think the trial court's own rulings actually indicate that there was sufficient evidence. Specifically, based on the facts that I just described, the trial court held that equity breached its implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing by misleading Atlantic Richfield into entering into this 1983 amendment. I think that finding in and of itself satisfies the element of unclean hands that the party who was seeking specific performance had engaged in improper conduct.
Implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing isn't the equivalent of unclean hands, though.
The unclean hands definition says any improper conduct. I would argue that a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing would be subsumed within unclean hands. I think unclean hands could be broader than that, certainly, but that bad faith actions toward a contract partner would certainly be subsumed within the definition of improper conduct.
Doesn't the unclean hands defense require some sort of substantial bad conduct? It can't just be any minor misconduct or misconduct that doesn't really relate to the subject matter of the litigation.
I think there's probably a range of improper conduct, but here, I mean, what happened was Equity made specific representations to Atlantic Richfield, untrue representations about the status of and its intent to continue its oil shale research. And the effect of that was to get Atlantic Richfield to give it this option and to delay Equity's additional conveyance of property. And those are the very specific things that Equity seeks to compel in this action. So here, the misrepresentations and the bad faith conduct are the basis for exactly what Equity is seeking relief on. And I think in that situation, it's Equity's obligation to come to the court with clean hands if it's seeking specific performance. And here, it appears that that's just not the case. The court held that, the
misrepresentation. Isn't enforcing the option just a legal remedy, not an equitable remedy, and unclean hands wouldn't apply?
Well, no, I think enforcement of the option here, because the trial court ordered conveyance of the specific real property, is an equitable remedy to which unclean hands would be a defense. Equity argues that Atlantic Richfield could have later canceled the option, and therefore somehow its unclean hands are waived. But in response to that, again, I think the focus here is on Equity's conduct, and did it come to court with clean hands? The fact that Atlantic Richfield didn't exercise its contract rights as aggressively as it could have in the future, I don't think cures that. Most importantly, because the trial testimony was that but for these misrepresentations, Atlantic Richfield would never have entered into this agreement. It had no incentive whatsoever to enter into the 1983 amendment, except for the hope that Equity would continue the oil shale research, and based on Equity's representations, that it was continuing that research. And so for Equity to come back and say that somehow Atlantic Richfield didn't act properly in the situation that Equity misled it into entering into, I think is not any defense to the unclean hands. I also want to talk about the trial court's decision that despite this breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and other breaches that the trial court found that Equity committed with respect to this agreement, that those were not material and therefore that Equity had substantially performed its end of the bargain. A review of the record in this case in conjunction with the relevant case law makes clear that this agreement had one purpose, and that was oil shale research. There's just overwhelming evidence that that's all these agreements were concerned with, from the provisions of the agreements themselves, the statements about by the parties at the time the agreements were being entered into. Most importantly, the correspondence leading up to the 1983 amendment makes clear that these parties were only talking about one thing, and that was the oil shale research on the Boys Block. I would specifically refer the court to Jack LaRue's letter of April 1983, when he expresses Atlantic Richfield's position, which is, this amendment is designed to give Equity the right to maintain a major position in the Boys Block so that you can continue your development work on the in-situ process. I think that really sums up what Atlantic Richfield's purpose was. And Equity's witness, Paul Dugan, at trial testified. His testimony was that Equity got two things from the 1983 amendment: extension of time to commercially produce oil shale, and the right to purchase Atlantic Richfield's full interest in the oil shale. And that's at the trial transcript at page 505. So the evidence is really undisputed that all of these property conveyances were only related to incentives to or the potential sharing of revenue from any development of oil shale. The district court relied on the case Lowry v. Palm and held that there were really two separate purposes here. And that's why the breaches weren't material, because the breaches were related to oil shale research and not to property conveyances. But as I've just described, the property conveyances here were completely integrated with the oil shale research purpose. And
I would say the trial court's position was that the property conveyances were the purpose of the agreement?
that there were two purposes. One was oil shale research and one was property conveyances. And that because these breaches related to oil shale research, it shouldn't affect the property conveyance aspect of the agreements. But again, the two were just completely integrated. And I think the review of the record shows that clearly. In order for this court to affirm the district court's judgment, it also has to find that the district court properly reformed the option at issue in this case under the reformation provision of the statutory rule against perpetuities.
Are we in agreement that the rule against perpetuities applies to the option?
The district court found that the rule against perpetuities applied. There are policy arguments in equity's brief around whether or not the rule should apply, but the district court clearly found that it did and found that the policy arguments raised by equity were not persuasive. I think review of the
district. Do you agree with that? I mean, are you conceding that the rule against perpetuities applies to an option, commercial option?
Oh, certainly our position that the rule against perpetuities applies, yes, okay. And that the option was void ab initio because of that. And so we are in agreement that the district court correctly found that the rule against common law rule against perpetuities applied to the option. Therefore, it was void ab initio and equity should never have been able to exercise the option. The district court however went on to reform the option pursuant to CRS section 1511-1106. But the plain language of that provision makes clear that it applies to donative probate type instruments. That section allows a court upon the petition of an interested person to reform the disposition by inserting a savings clause that preserves most closely the transferor's manifested plan of distribution. The word distribution is not defined in the probate code, but it's defined by Black's Law Dictionary as the process of dividing an estate. And although distribution is not defined in the code, distributee is, and it defines a distributee as any person who has received the property of a decedent.
So your position is that by use of this term plan of distribution, that that's plain enough language that the statute doesn't apply to the type of commercial interest that's at issue here?
Well, let me go one further. It also uses the term upon the petition of an interested person. And interested person is defined in the probate code as an heir, devisee, children, spouses, creditors, beneficiaries, and any others having a property right in or claim against a trust estate or the estate of a decedent, ward, or protected person. And so again,
your position is that the common law rule applies, not the statutory rule.
Correct. We would agree that the statutory rule against perpetuities, which was not adopted until 1991, did not apply to this option. This option was
created. Was not by its terms or merely because it was not adopted prior to the date of the option?
Both. The statutory rule against perpetuities excludes commercial transactions from its application. And so this wouldn't, this instrument would not be governed by the existing statutory rule against perpetuities as it is today. But because this option was created in 1983, at that time, the common law rule against perpetuities was in effect. And our position is that the trial court was not permitted to reform it under the statutory rule against perpetuities. One, because that rule, by its plain language, does not allow the court to reform commercial instruments like this. And two, because if it did, it would be interpreting the statute in a way that would be a retrospective legislation and deprive Atlantic Richfield of its vested rights in that voice box property. Your Honor, I see I have 2 minutes left. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. Catherine Haight, Welborn Sullivan, Meck and Tooley, and with me at counsel table is my partner, Keith Tooley. I'd like to start, Your Honors, at the outset, noting that at least one factor that came to light this morning when I was doing my research in preparation of this oral argument. On June 18th, Friday, the Nebraska Supreme Court issued an opinion on the rule against perpetuities. And I emailed counsel with a copy this morning, and I don't know if she had a chance to look at it, and I won't argue it. I'll just cite it for the court. The case is Bauermeister versus Waste Management Company of Nebraska. It's 2010 Westlaw 243-1014. And again, it was just issued Friday by the Nebraska Supreme Court. It too involves a commercial option. It's an option to repurchase property, such as the option in our case. except in that case, it's non-cancelable. Ours is cancelable. And I have copies if the court would like me to.
I'm going to get the number straight. 2010241014.
2010 Westlaw 2431014. Your Honor, going back to the argument about the good faith and fair dealing, I think that ARCO's counsel's bad faith argument makes a serious omission in this case, and that is the trial court never found that equity proceeded in bad faith, and it's not supported by the record. The court did find that in 1982, equity's written disclosures to ARCO did not include specific reference to equities, oil shale research prospects, and that it somehow violated the duty of good faith and fair dealing. But the court nonetheless found that it was not material. It was not only not material, but back in 1982 when this supposedly occurred, it was public knowledge that oil shale was not, the oil shale projects weren't going forward. In fact, your honors might remember that in 1982, that's when Black Sunday, when oil shale was shut down on the Western Slope, that was well known to ARCO. That was well known to everyone in the industry. Oil shale was not proceeding in terms of any sort of commercial viability.
That was Union Oil, I think, that pulled out. It's not clear that everybody abandoned the idea of one day exploiting oil shale.
No, you're absolutely right, Your Honor. And equity never abandoned the idea of oil shale and still hasn't. The problem is it cannot be produced in commercial quantities today. It couldn't in 1983. It couldn't in 1982. Couldn't in 1968. But the hope is still there. And equity and a lot of folks, I think Shell is still working on it, are trying to produce commercial quantities of oil shale. It's not feasible until prices for oil and gas are substantially more than we pay today. I think it's also important to note that on this issue of good faith and fair dealing, I would draw the court's attention to a certain trial testimony of John Harden. He was an ARCO consultant. And I would draw your attention to Exhibits 28, 163, 170, 178. John Harden was retained by ARCO in 1995, for the sole purpose of disposing of the Boyce Flat property. In 1995, he contacts equity and sees that he sees the status of oil shale production on the property. He's there. He talks to Paul Dugan. It's completely understandable to him that, yes, there's an interest in oil shale. No, it's not going forward. It's not commercially feasible. He reports that to ARCO. He nonetheless looks at the property because he is charged with selling the Boyce Block. He looks at the property and determines that he could probably sell it for, at the time, this in the late 90s, he could probably sell it at the time for something like $300 a square foot. The option in this case, if equity exercised it in the 90s and as it exercised it subsequently in 2006, the option required equity to pay over $3,000 an acre. It was not financially attractive.
The square foot originally, you mean
I'm
acre.
Sorry, per acre, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I am doing some work on my house. But it was very clear to ARCO then that it wasn't feasible for them to just simply go sell the property to somebody else at $300 an acre. Plus, in the option, equity retained the right. There was a right of first refusal. So equity is sitting back saying, listen, if ARCO wants to sell the Boyce Block, we're here to buy. At $300 an acre instead of $3,000 an acre to exercise the option, we're happy to do that. That saves us a lot of money. ARCO backs away, decides they don't want to sell the deal. They want to keep their hands on it because If Equity ever exercises before February 2008, and remember they exercised in 2006, if Equity exercised before February 2008, it would be over $3,000 per acre. Now that looked pretty good to ARCO at the time. What ARCO apparently didn't appreciate at the time, and perhaps nobody did, was how much that particular area of the Western Slope would benefit parties who were involved in oil and gas production. Equity was involved in certain federal units adjacent to the property. The Boys Block itself actually had been subject to an oil and gas lease since 1955. ARCO was receiving royalties on it. You know, all of these properties, ARCO was receiving royalties on any use you could put to that, put the surface to on the Boys Block. They were receiving oil and gas royalties. And to suggest that somehow or other this agreement only involved oil and gas research, when you're talking about $20,000 figure four block, or 20,000 acre figure four block, the 5,000 acre Sunset block, and the 2,000 acre Boys block, which are all part of this deal. Oil shale research was being conducted on 10 acres on the Boys block, and so to suggest that somehow or other this all collapses into an oil shale project and nothing more is just a misstatement.
Also, I'd like to turn to the statutory interpretation.
Yes.
It is fairly curious language that's used in this rule of perpetuities reform statute, plan of distribution, and it seems that it would apply to just the probate donative type interest. Do you have any response to that language?
Your Honor, I think actually the best response is the trial court's response, and I'm happy to refer you to it. It's in the judge's ruling on dispositive motions, and he analyzed every one of the arguments that ARCO is making here today, and I think he did an excellent job on it. Now, I find that the language is difficult, but I think it still applies, because the archaic rule against perpetuities should never apply to commercial transactions. It was originally designed for donative transfers, completely limited to donative transfers. And then it got pulled into commercial transactions at some point, and it just simply doesn't fit. And as I think the court is aware, when you're dealing with sophisticated oil and gas companies in this case, who have made a decision that there should be a 25-year option on a piece of property, the 21 years of within the life and being at the time of the creation of the interest seems like a pretty archaic rule, and it doesn't yield itself at all to the commercial purposes that were being served.
In light of the lack of clarity of the statutory language, is there any need for us to look into the legislative intent? And if so, have you actually looked into that at all?
I have looked into it, Your Honor, and I welcome you to do so too, and I can't give you any guidance in that regard. but I would say to you, Your Honor, that the weight of authority is pulling away and saying that the rule against perpetuity simply does not apply in a commercial context. It never should have, and it shouldn't in the future. Because what you end up doing is depriving parties of the benefit of the bargain. There are all kinds of, you know, in the negotiation process, there's a give and take. And in that give and take, there are things that are given up in terms of, I want a 25-year option, that 25-year option is granted.
Let me ask you about this. We have law, though, in Colorado that applies the rule against perpetuities in the context of a commercial option. Now, certainly maybe not revocable like this one was, but it's difficult for me to understand how we can just depart and say that the rule of perpetuities doesn't apply to a commercial instrument when there is existing law that apparently applies it.
I think that is the development of the common law, and that, I suppose, is my point, that, you know, when the court started to go down that road of applying the rule against perpetuities to commercial transactions, in about 1980, you see this real resistance to it springing up all across the country, saying, how does this apply, and what possibly is served by applying it in a commercial transaction? The purposes behind the rule against perpetuities simply don't work. You don't have a dead hand control of wealth. What you have is a negotiated transaction. And what is so important in this case, and there's authority that we've cited in our brief, that when that option is cancelable, the rule doesn't apply at all, because the control over that option, as in this case, is in the hands of ARCO. ARCO could at any time have said, and you'll see it in the option itself, option canceled for whatever reason.
Then doesn't it just convert back to the right of first refusal?
Then there's a right of first refusal, and that right of first refusal would expire in February 2008.
Given the timeline in this case, could you address the argument that the statutory rule is unconstitutionally retrospective?
Your Honor, I have set forth a lot of that argument in my brief, and the trial court dealt with it as well. And I think the key is this. When these commercial entities sat down to negotiate this transaction, the intent was and the expectation was February 2, 1159 on February 1, 2008, this option would expire. When you look at the rules involving retrospective application of law, they look to the harm or to somehow or other denying the parties their reasonable expectations and what they negotiated for. Well, here, by not applying the rule against perpetuities, you grant the parties exactly what they requested. And I do think that the rule simply doesn't apply in this case, but I think that to the extent that the court determined that it did apply, and in that we disagree, and obviously it's a matter for de novo review for you, but in rejecting our claim that the rule didn't apply, the court then did endorse the public policy announced by the legislature in that it shouldn't apply to commercial transactions, and after 1991 it does not, period, but to those that fall into that window, ours, then the court may reform. It may draft a savings clause that would preserve the party's intent. Now, I know that we're dealing with the language of that particular statute, but the legislature and the court concluded that to preserve the party's intent, that's exactly what should be done. And that's why the court imposed the savings clause to the option agreement. Your Honors, I see my time is way up. I thought I saw the red light.
Anything more you want to say?
The other thing I would like to note for the court, and that is that I cited the exhibits to you. There's and Mr. Hardin's testimony at pages 593 to 616. He makes clear he is ARCO for all practical purposes during this critical period of time. ARCO never complains about equities conduct until trial. I might also note that it didn't complain about equities conduct at all until a year after the complaint was filed.
I'm not exactly sure of all the time frames, but ARCO put up $2 million or something for research at some point, prior to 83, I'm sure.
In 1968. And then
the federal government put up another $8 million, and that was also prior to 83 or prior to...
No, that was 83.
That was after 83 or...
1983, pursuant to the, you know, once the amendment was... I'm incorrect, Your Honor. Prior to 1983, Department of Energy did put up a certain amount of money. Equity also put up like $3 million. Equity is doing all the labor, all the work, but in conjunction with the Department of Energy, is producing, you know, the information, you know, in terms of oil shale research. The project produced gas from oil shale, no doubt about it. But it produced something like 1 to 2 barrels a day. You can imagine how uneconomic that is. That doesn't mean that someday it won't be. And as the court is aware, within the last few years, with the prices going up, sure enough, people are marching back to the Western Slope saying, now that oil shale, we're going to get that out of the rock one day. And maybe they will. But right now, nowhere in the world is oil shale being produced from oil, or is oil being produced from oil shale.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Judge Romano, I want to return to your question about the waiver of the unclean hands defense real quick, because I think it's very important that a defense was in the case. We cited in our marriage of right in our briefs to show that we had preserved that defense. I do have one additional citation I wanted to give the court. It's 160 P3rd 307. Those two cases make clear that you don't even have to say the name of a defense, which we actually did, to preserve it as long as you...
160 P3rd what?
307. Counsel for equity just stated that the district court never held that equity acted in bad faith. I would refer the court to paragraph 39 of the court's judgment, which says, by misleading ARCO in this fashion, the court does conclude equity breached its implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. So I believe that would be a finding that the district court did conclude that equity acted in bad faith with respect to making these misrepresentations. Counsel talked about the fact that oil shale was failing on the western slope, and there's two key points I want to bring to the court's attention on that. First, all three of the properties involved in this case were for the purpose of oil shale research. Figure 4 and Sunset involved a retorting mining process, and the Boys Block involved an in-situ, a different type of process for recovering oil shale. Black Sunday was Exxon pulling out of its project, which was related to the retorting process. After that, the Boys Block became of paramount importance because it was looking at a different process and was the only property left within the whole deal that had a potential for oil shale development. Going back to the rule against perpetuities, I just want to reiterate that in this case, the trial court found that the common law policies, the rule, applied here and that the rule did apply. Counsel has spent a lot of time talking about the policies of the common law rule against perpetuities. We've moved on from those as a society, but in this case, the court considered those arguments and determined that the rule did apply. I see my time is up. Thank you.
We had two authorities cited to us during the argument that apparently were not in the briefs. And so if the appellant wishes within a period of prior to the close of business 1 week from today, respond or comment on a case that apparently appears at 2010 Westlaw 2430142. Is that right?
243104.
243-01. What's the name of the case? It's Bauermeister, B-A-U-E-R-M-E-I-S-T-E-R versus Waste Management of Nebraska, 2010 Westlaw 243104, June 18, 2010.
Have a site.
This is Paratransit Authority, 160 P3rd
307. And if appellee wishes to in any way comment or respond to that authority cited by appellant's counsel, you have the same time period until the close of business next week on Monday to do so. And both of you do it in a letter format, not to exceed 4 pages, addressed to the members of the panel. By addressing it to the members of the panel, it'll come directly to us and not go through the filing system for the flat file and so forth. And we'll have it available to us quicker, more assuredly also. There being nothing further, the case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. And the bailiff may announce, the court will be in recess subject to call, and the bailiff may so announce.
Thank you.